You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Stars. Joining me tonight, my trusty co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, witnessing Johnny WrestleMania on Friday on TV was absolutely insane. How did you experience it in person?
It was crazy, man. Like, Johnny's a lightning bolt of a player, period. Like, that's just who he is. But the first goal was really nice. It was like, okay, what the heck is Roger Espinoza doing as a wing back over here? And then the second goal was all Roger Espinoza again, getting the ball off Waston and playing him down in, and he scores. And then the fight happened. And from upstairs, from our view in the press box, it was kind of like straight on from us. The fight was, at least the field, the angle for it. I wasn't like craning around from the backside, because stuff that happens on, so if you're looking at the field from the press box from right to left, stuff happens on the left side of the field, the angle is really bad because it's the farther end from the press box. The press box is up, you're looking at the field, is up on the right hand corner. So we're up on that side where that happened, and so we had a direct straight view towards that, just kind of up over the top of everything that was going on. I thought I had seen like some type of punch or something get like someone's arm go forward and a Sporting KC player's head go back. So I was assuming that there was going to be a red card coming from it, but the madness and then the scrambling in the press box from us too to like figure out what the heck actually happened. And we didn't really know until like they actually started walking off the field that it was them. And then the in-stadium PA announcer announced that Kendall Waston was the one who got one of the red cards. And he was turning around, freaking out. And all, it was like kind of mass chaos. And then we looked up and it was the 45th minute. And then the referee held up the board and he's like, 8 minutes of stoppage time. And we're just like, oh my gosh. Like, that first half was nuts. And the Sporting KC play guy came into the bathroom with all of us at the end of it, the play-by-play guy, Nate Bucati, and he came into the bathroom at halftime, and he walks in the door, and there's a lot of us in there, and he's like, man, that was a boring half of soccer, and like everyone just chuckled, like, like goodness, like it was absolutely crazy. The second half was a lot more chill, because one, you know, the result's already out of question at that point, but I mean, the whole experience, I mean, all of MLS last weekend was just crazy. It was lit pretty much everywhere. But, you know, what a way to kick it off with that one. A 6-0 on a Friday night. And, you know, the press box was open, so you had that crowd atmosphere. It's the first time it was warm enough this whole offseason, or this whole season, for us to actually open the windows in the press box. And it was so nice to finally have that. It was a little breezy. But I think even the media staff were like, yeah, we're just sick of having the windows shut. Even if it's like 65 and breezy, you know, we're going to go. But enough about me ranting on, or not ranting, but enough of me rambling on the wild night at Children's Mercy Park with Johnny Russell going crazy. It was a really cool performance, and there was already some historical stuff on Matt Beasler's end that kind of made the night special for Sporting KC fans, and, you know, kind of celebrating what he's done for the team over the years. And then you have Johnny Russell going off, and, you know, this team's fun. We were looking at it. Maybe we can kind of talk about it, I guess. But they have 20 goals in their first 8 games, which is half of their total that they had all of last season already. They've got that. They have 2 players with 5 goals, which I think led their team for in scoring, like in the regular season, like MLS. I think Aiko Parra had like 4 last year. So, you know, we're this is the Sporting Kansas City team is something else to watch. Their games have become, if in the MLS Live Kingdom, their games for the last couple of years have been considered snoozers if you weren't paying attention to it, just because of the lack of goals. Now it's a little crazy. You kind of got to tune into this to see what the heck they're doing.
Speaking of crazy games and sarcastically boring games of soccer, Daniel Sperry, in segment one, we will be recapping Toronto FC's unfortunate loss in the 2018 CONCACAF Champions League. Listeners, we're recording this on the evening of Thursday, the 26th. That means if you're listening to us on Friday, 2 days ago, Wednesday night, down at Estadio Akron in Jalisco, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Chivas USA defeated Toronto FC. They played to a 2-1 scoreline in favor of Toronto through 90 minutes, no extra time, not going to 120 minutes, go straight to PKs. And unfortunately for the Reds and for MLS fans rooting for them, Chivas USA were victorious. Chivas come out and start immediately throwing punches. Orbelin Pinedo scores in the 19th minute. Jozy Altidor responds in the 25th with a really, really nice move after Nick Hasler dances around in the box a little bit. And then Sebastian Giovinco, with a little bit of clap backing at the official after getting a yellow card, scores a very Sebastian Giovinco on the run type of goal. Fairly back and forth second half until the final 20 minutes, in which Toronto just absolutely runs out of gas. I can't remember what the name of the Chivas player was, but I want to say it was Javier Lopez, but don't quote me on that. Appears off camera to clock Sebastian Giovinco as he's making a run towards the Chivas goal with the official in the vicinity and with a good look at it, but nothing is called. They end up playing in 90 minutes, totally parking the bus in the final 10 to 15 minutes. And then when we get into PKs, every single Chivas player scores. They wrong foot Alex Bono on a number of cases. Jonathan Osorio in the bottom of the second round. Bottom of the second round, puts his shot off the bar, and then to actually close out to make it 4-2 in favor of Chiefs and PKs, Michael Bradley skies the ball into the stands. I'm not sure if it's landed yet. Dan, this is an extremely disappointing result for a team that I thought overall for the 180 minutes was the better team and was in perfect position to win CCL, but history remains unchanged. An MLS team has yet to win CCL in the current iteration of the format, and let's face it, a relatively average Mexican team, despite all of Chivas' history, are walking away with the trophy, and Toronto have absolutely nothing. And they still are last in the entire MLS standings in the supporter shield in points. And now they've just got to focus on trying to get back into a playoff spot.
Yeah, and the early MLS season is forgiving, so I don't have any problem. I'm not worried about them necessarily going forward. But this event, it does suck, considering what happened. And you know, this team, maybe with Chris Mavinga, Drew Moore, and everybody in there, this result doesn't go this way. I thought they actually played one of their best games of the season at Estadio Akron. I think the second half got a little dicey. Chivas were really putting them under pressure, but they had chances very, very late to finish that off. And, you know, look at Marky Delgado blasting his chance over, and, you know, the forward whose name is escaping me that had replaced Jozy Altidor that came in and Jordan Hamilton had a chance there, and he just couldn't bundle it home after, you know, they got down the byline there. It's really disappointing because Toronto FC played some of the best soccer out of any of these teams throughout the entire tournament. But that's the way these things go, is it? Sometimes the best team doesn't always win in that. It's about that performance that you give, and you know, they were a little bit leaky at the back at home, and it cost them. In reality, you look at the series between these two teams, that first leg completely cost them, because you know they went down and they got a result for the most part in Mexico all three times that they were asked to in this tournament, and you know, not many MLS teams have done that before, and for them to even come up, you know, losing on that is a little. It just sucks, and you know, penalty kicks ends up as a crapshoot, and it's whoever holds their composure and whichever goalkeeper can, you know, read the runner right. That's how the penalty kick shootouts go. And so I feel bad for Toronto FC, but I think this run for Toronto FC in this tournament should, despite them not lifting the cup, I think should be quite a heralded run for an MLS team in the history of this tournament. Because, you know, Montreal, who made it to the final a couple years ago, their run was very, very lucky, and they didn't have to play anyone amazing until they played America in the final and they got the floor wiped with them. This Toronto FC team, you know, went and put in a good performance every single time. for the most part. And I, you know, they put in the type of effort that I thought they needed to in the second leg. And, you know, they're undermanned because of the defensive issues and that defensive health issues that they have. You know, Giovinco, I thought once he got mad, just really got into the game, and you see him, you get him, gets in that space, cuts in, and then cuts the shot to the angle that, you know, probably messes with the keeper the most. As a keeper, you hate that. As a player, because I used to play goalkeeper, as a player is driving from your right to left, you're driving with that motion from that post over, and as your momentum, and most of the time, your weight is leaning to that left side, and then for him to cut back to your near post once he's pushed you over to cheat too much like that, and if you catch that goalkeeper cheating, you can shoot that shot into the near post just like he did on that play, and it was really well executed from him. He found the space to put it. That's the second hardest part for the striker in that position, is once you fool the goalkeeper, is to find the space to cut it back into the near post, because the defender at times is naturally pushing you to, and is naturally giving you that far post curler. So when you turn around and can push that into that near post like that, it'll throw a goalkeeper off, and two, you've done a really good job to create space for that shot. And that was textbook Giovinco, something he's done in MLS since he's gotten here, just being able to read the situation between him and the defender and the goalkeeper correctly and put in the right type of shot. Amazing there. Josie Altidore's goal on the corner kick was really good. They did a really good job of keeping that ball alive and fighting to keep that play alive after the corner kick was kind of harmless in general. So, you know, the goal from Chivas was really nice too. And that's a hard part too with that, is, you know, you look at the goal from Chivas. It was a very well-worked play. It was a great run from Orbelin Pineda and a great ball into him to score that, and a really good finish to get into that space and slot it home. So, you know, it was a very good performance all around from Toronto FC. I don't think you can fault them too much on the goal that they gave up in that game. And, you know, they come out, they win the game, and then they lose on penalty kicks. It's just a overall unlucky result. And, you know, it sucks for an MLS team to play that well in that moment and feel like they probably should have come out with something and they didn't.
This final for me, Dan, was almost a war of attrition. You look at what Toronto had to go through, you know, whether it was the elements and, you know, a gritty, brand new defensive Colorado Rapids team probably put up a lot more of a fight than, you know, say one of those random Central South American teams that, you know, was completely undermatched as far as overall talent, quality, and organization that Toronto would have faced. The only real benefit that they had was not having to travel as much, because you were at least staying, well, not within country, but, you know, Toronto to Colorado as opposed to Toronto to somewhere in random Guatemala, for example. And then they have to take on two super teams in Liga MX and Tigres, and in Club America, getting through that. From basically the second round on, Chivas knew that they were in a position where they're not going to get relegated in Liga MX, but they're in no way, like, they would have to go on an absolute tear in the second half of, I think it's, I always mix up whether it's the Apertura or the Clausura, but whatever current season is going on in Mexico, they would have had to have gone through a tear in order to make it into the playoffs. So they're kind of like that. They're kind of like that MLS team that's completely out of the playoffs, for example, but is in a quarterfinal of the U.S. Open Cup, where they're going to have to, you know, play great for 3 or 4 months just to get into the playoffs. But they only need to win 3 more games in order to win a trophy. And then, you know, you look at it, Chivas, you know, had, you know, a Seattle Sounders team that I thought completely bungled the second half. They got to play a New York Red Bulls team that completely bungled the second half. They had a relatively easier path to the final than Toronto had. And then compound that with, you know, other than the two most recent league games for Toronto, you know, where they essentially started, you know, barely a USL playoff team against Houston, got blown out, lost 2-0 to the Colorado Rapids a couple weekends ago. They were fighting a two-fronted campaign. So you have one team coming in here relatively healthy, has no other competition to take seriously or care about or has any stock in, can entirely throw their starters into this game, had an easier path to get to the final as opposed to Toronto that had to slay two dragons, fight a two-fronted campaign on that, and then it's really tough with the yellow card accumulation rules they have for this tournament, that it doesn't reset for the final, that you essentially have to go 8 games with only committing 2 yellow cards, which I thought was really, really tough. You know, I agree with you that I think if Toronto had their full set of defenders available, that they would have looked a little bit better. I do want to throw a tip to the cap on Greg Vanny on trying to make this work, and it almost did. I saw this lineup, and I immediately thought, what are you doing with Vanderbilt and Bradley at center back, and what is Nick Hasler doing out wide, so to speak? But you look at it with the way that Chivas has been marking defensively, it's all been man. And so with Bradley sitting that deep, that forced Pulido, Pineda, and in some case Bizarro to sort of pull up, and then that created so much space in the midfield that even with Toronto's backline laying relatively deep, they had easy passes to outlet to the shuttlers in the midfield and Delgado and Osorio to spring the counterattack. And both of those I thought were really critical in creating the opportunities that ultimately led to the goals for Altidore and Giovinco. I just really thought that the midfield ran out of gas. You know, Osorio and Delgado have been money in this tournament, but they just seemed to run out of it. Obviously, Vasquez was never going to go a full 90 minutes, his first game since, I believe, the MLS opener against Columbus for Toronto. So in that sense, you know, if there was a slightly healthier or a slightly more prepared Toronto team, or maybe they do, you know, maybe the away leg is leg one and maybe the home leg is leg two. You know, it's really disappointing. I just echo Matt Doyle's point that you look at it, Toronto and everything that they did, you know, failing in the playoffs against Montreal, then doing much better, getting the MLS Cup, then losing MLS Cup, then figuring out how to win MLS Cup. Maybe this was almost a necessary failure for Toronto, such that when they get back into this tournament, if this current iteration is able to qualify and make it back to the final, that now they'll absolutely seal the deal. So that's maybe the one sort of little positive thing that we have here. Dan, let's go to the overall legacy standpoint, because, you know, fairly or unfairly, like, everybody's going to look at that and see the ultimate dagger that down Toronto was Michael Bradley skying his PK over the wall, when I feel like, it, you know, this could go much greater to the team in terms of how they play defensively, offensively, and everything. But that's everything that's everyone's going to remember. And they're going to remember this after a year in which there have been a lot of really jeering highlight reels for Michael Bradley overall as far as his legacy is concerned. How do you make sense of that? How much of that is on him? Does any of this impact Jose Altidore and just Toronto's overall aura as a team that I think was ready to be a budding dynasty in MLS 2018?
You know, I think that he is going to – he and Jose Altidore, I think, are never going to garner the correct appreciation that they deserve. And everyone's going to look at this game, and like you said, they're going to look at that penalty miss that we, you know, we joked – so not sure if it's landed yet. And that's going to be everyone's half-judgment legacy of him, as he captained the U.S. men's national team to World Cup qualifying failure for the 2018 World Cup. And then he shanked a penalty kick in the final, after he just had put in a 90-minute performance, by the way, out of position at center back, that was actually really freaking good. You will never be able to appease
the internet Twitter haters.
That, but I'm trying to think of a right metaphor for it. And I was thinking, like, there's like a hungry, hungry hippo type thing. And you're never going to be able, like, the hippos are always going to bite at something. They're always going to find something to bite at every single time you push their buttons. Michael Bradley is one of those guys who pushes the button. In my head, I was more thinking like a shark, you know, like people just kind of trolling out of the bottom, trying to find something and grab it. Hungry, hungry hippos may be the worst comparison ever, so don't listen to me on that. But Michael Bradley is going to be the guy that garners this. He garners a lot of attention from the role that he's in. He is a captain of the best team in MLS, by far. He is the captain of he was the captain of the U.S. men's national team. And, you know, he has been a fixture in that team for a very long time. And there are two significant failures for him in the last calendar year. In the last 365 days, there are two significant failures there that he has that come with him. And that people are going to blame him for, rightly or wrongly. And most of the time it's going to be wrongly, because, you know, Michael Bradley, week in, week out, puts in a very good performance. Has a bad game in the game against Trinidad, fine, move on. MLS Cup, balls out. He and Josie balled out and absolutely tore apart Seattle in that game. Then you go to this tournament, and he was fantastic the whole tournament, and then he just skies a penalty there at the end. And, you know, stuff happens. Some guys are just not good at penalty kicks. That's just how it goes. I thought I was a decent goal scorer once I switched to forward. I could not make a penalty kick for my life. I had two of them blocked in games, and I stopped taking penalty kicks because it was never worth it. Because that was just not something I was really, really good at that mind game, but I could score goals from other spots. Some people just aren't good at them, and I think that's something that you kind of have to accept. There is a mentality and something that goes behind taking those penalty kicks, and for some reason there people are going to use that as a knock on Michael Bradley, the soccer player, when I think that would be incredibly unfair, an unfair take on Toronto FC. And it's a great thing to tweet and get a whole bunch of retweets and likes and, you know, interactions and stuff like that, but it's the entirely incorrect opinion about what went down last night.
I'm going to agree with you there, Dan. You know, I'm not someone who's a big fan of making these sort of snap judgments on players' legacies. In a past life, I was an undergrad at the University of Miami right as LeBron James was coming to the Miami Heat. And there was a huge argument, because everybody knew that I was a Lakers fan, obviously, of comparing LeBron to Kobe. And I finally think we're getting at a point, you know, now about to enter, you know, this fall will be the third season without Kobe Bryant. And I finally think we're getting to a point where we can look back at history and him and start to compare. I don't think, like, the final chapters of LeBron James' legacy haven't been remotely there. So, you know, I would say we need at least 5 years of a player being gone in order to understand their legacy and what they've brought. And I think, you know, regardless of what you say about what he's done from a national team level, there's impacts that Bradley has had on MLS and on Toronto FC that are going to stand the test of time, and that are going to put them in a better situation after the day after he retires, or the day after he leaves Toronto, regardless of how that goes about, than the day that before he signed with Toronto. And I don't think we can take anything away from him on that. And I guess just on the U.S. national team side, like, you know, it's kind of like with Arsene Wenger now retiring, where, you know, you had the fans and the pundits who for months, if not years, or even potentially a decade, had been crying Wenger out, where as soon as they realize that it's over and Wenger, you know, has what, 4 or 5 games left to manage for Arsenal, that the first things that they come out with are talking about the Invincibles and the FA Cup runs, you know, all the people who seem to be his biggest haters and his biggest critics, the first thing they respond to once they're now in a reflective standpoint is all the positive stuff. And there's a lot of good things that Michael Bradley's done for the U.S. national team, for soccer in America, for Americans abroad, in terms of what he did at Roma, in terms of, you know, the other things that he did at European clubs, in terms of what he's doing and has done for Toronto FC, the Gold Cups that he's been a participant in. You know, I don't think an individual game or an individual moment is entirely his fault. You know, him missing the PK it might have been the straw that broke the camel's back, but, you know, it wasn't the singular, you know, it wasn't Luke Skywalker blowing up the Death Star that downed the empire that is Toronto FC, so to speak. So I think we need a little bit more time. I think we need a little bit more perspective, and we need to balance the good things that Bradley is brought and the bad things that Bradley will bring. Since our listeners are probably thinking about this also in a U.S. national team context, I'll just say one final thing that I mentioned on Twitter when I was having a conversation with a listener of the pod, saying I think there's still one final chapter for Bradley to write from a U.S. national team standpoint, whether or not he's even going to be a relevant fixture or a starter in the 2022 World Cup cycle or even make it to Qatar. There's an entire new younger generation that knows him as sort of the industry as the national team standard in terms of how to carry yourself, how to be a leader, and whether or not you think he succeeded or failed in that, he is an opportunity to provide mentorship and show them how to grow into their own and maybe be better than what he was, so to speak. And so whether that's Bradley doing that with, like, phone calls while not getting called up, whether that's him being the wily old veteran, you know, a borderline player coach sort of a thing, like if he can be what Miroslav Klose was to Germany for the 2006 World Cup cycle and the World Cup in Germany in 2006, then that's going to put the U.S. national team in a better place for 2022 in terms of qualifying and getting there, regardless of how significant Bradley is in terms of minutes playing, or even if before he retires or doesn't even make the World Cup roster. Dan, I'll throw you to you for the last word on this segment. Any other closing thoughts on Michael Bradley's legacy, Jose Altidore's legacy, whether or not Toronto wins this thing in 2019, or just the match in general?
Well, better be prepared for Toronto FC to come out with a vengeance in 2019. Look at what happened last year with the MLS Cup. They came through and ran roughshod through MLS. destroyed everyone, won the MLS Cup. They're going to come back with a vengeance as long as everybody is back and healthy. And don't be shocked for them in 2019. They're qualified. You know, they won MLS Cup, they won Supporters Shield, they won Eastern Conference. They're definitely there. So, you know, this is a team that they're not going to just go away. Just because they lost this game, just because Michael Bradley skied a penalty kick, they are going to be back in 2019 and expect them to be a favorite to win it all after the type of performance that they put in throughout the tournament in 2019. And again, I just feel like this is a team that, you know, this run that we look at maybe a few years from now is going to be a run that should be heralded, considering what they did and going into beating Tigres and going in to Monterrey, into the Azteca and into Estadio Akron and getting the results necessary. That is a thing that no other MLS team has done in any time in this CONCACAF Champions League. So really the run should be heralded. It's an unfortunate end on something that's a crapshoot like penalty kicks end up being. But this is one of the best runs that the MLS team has ever had in this tournament. And it should be remembered as such.
Just one quick fact check for you on air before we head to break here, Dan. Toronto FC is not qualified for the 2019 CONCACAF Champions League. The four American representatives will be the 2017 and 2018 U.S. Open Cup champions. So Sporting Kansas City has already punched their ticket to the knockout rounds for next year. And then it will be the MLS Cup champion or the finalist as far as an American team is concerned. And then the aggregate between U.S. teams with the best aggregate record, so total points for the 2017 and 2018 MLS regular season. According to the rules that I'm looking at right now, Toronto's only path to the 2019 CONCACAF Champions League round of 16 is the 2018 Canadian Championship. So they have not qualified, but given where Montreal and Vancouver are right now and whichever USL team from Canada, Calgary, Edmonton, or the Ottawa Fury at this point, I would put Toronto as the odds-on favorite to walk away with that tournament. But in any case, so they have not officially qualified. And just for reference, in case anybody's wondering, on the Mexican side, it's the Apertura and the Clausura. Champions and runners-up for 2017 in the Apertura and 2018 in the Clausura. So last fall for the Apertura, this current season right now, the Clausura top two teams for reference from 2017 who've already punched their ticket, Monterrey and Tigres. So lots to happen, lots still in terms of qualifying for the American, Mexican, and Canadian teams for the 2019 tournament. Here's hoping that finally an MLS team can actually win this thing and actually make it to a Club World Cup. Listeners, we'll be right back with the roundtable. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. LastWordOnSoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Fame Network, and Roughneck Scarves. Head over to RoughneckScarves.com for all of your custom scarf needs here in the United States. Okay, Dan, it is time for the roundtable. For those of you who've been living under a Twitter rock, Arsene Wenger announced earlier this week, or maybe it was over the weekend, I can't remember, that he will be stepping down as the head manager of Arsenal Football Club. And now there's a whole bunch of buzz because apparently a whole bunch of people here in the U.S. think that Patrick Vieira should be getting it. Dan, your thoughts on the general impending Arsenal opening, maybe what that means for the club in the context of greater football, what it means for Patrick Vieira, and more importantly, does this mean that potentially Bruce Arena ends up taking it and then Anthony Hudson is now on the hot seat because Kroenke Sports Entertainment owns both Arsenal and the Colorado Rapids, and Arsene Wenger is now a free agent?
Yeah, so I love the conspiracy theories on that, man. Like, just Kroenke just flipping people around. Patrick Vieira. I just don't know if he's quite there, quite ready to be the coach there and do something there. I'm sure, you know, he'll go in and he'll give an interview and he'll do something that, and they'll be like, oh, you know, that's kind of impressive. Let's give you a shot. It's an interesting rumor. I think it's kind of funny. It is always good. It's going to be a tough job for whoever actually replaces him. As a Manchester United fan, you know that, you know, once Sir Alex Ferguson left, it was a crapshoot for everyone to fill in those roles. Um, I I don't think whoever succeeds him is going to be successful. Is going to be very successful. I think they'll continue to kind of be where they're at, which is a Europa League team at the moment in the context of in the context of English Premier League. And I know we don't normally dive into that, but you know, I don't think whoever changes that, but I think it's kind of cool for Patrick Vieira to be at least linked with it. And the fact that, you know, some sources across the sea are kind of like, you know, man, you know, what about Patrick Vieira? You know, New York City FC is playing really well right now. And, you know, they have been, and this is they're a very well coached team. He's got good ideas in what he's doing. It's just a very different league. You know, can't just go sit there and, oh, cool. I can go buy. Oh, this guy is kind of interested. Man, he fits. Let's go buy. Let's just say, hey, we're going to buy, pay your money, you know, pay your transfer fee. You can come play for us. That doesn't really work with MLS and New York City FC, is there's a bit of a recruitment to find someone to get there and to find the fringe player from somewhere else that would be interested in the move to MLS. So, you know, it's probably be able to get exactly who he wants to come play for him at Arsenal. But I do think he's a good coach. I think he's impressive in his tenure especially his demeanor as the head coach. And, you know, I actually finally got a chance to speak with him this season during the season opener. And I got, you know, talk with him and ask him a couple questions about how he'd set up his team for the win and his thoughts on bringing, you know, a player like Jesus Medina. And, you know, his response to that was that, you know, there is a huge assimilation time for him and that they were taking that very, very seriously. And I thought that was a really, for a coach like him and for a team like New York City FC that is demanding success first, to have that type of patience with a potential young starlet like that, and to really, you know, be very vocal and serious about having that type of patience with that type of player. I think he could do good things at Arsenal if that were to be the case. I'd be more than happy to see Bruce Arena coach Arsenal. That would be an all-out barnstormer. And, you know, what do we have? We have Brad Bobley or something like that from the Soccer AM crew in there. I'd love to see, you know, a Bruce Arena, you know, joke spin that some great British comedy group will have a laugh at with Arsenal. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I'm all for Bruce Arena, or better yet, let's go Jurgen Klinsmann to Arsenal and we can see how that lights everything up in flames. It'll be interesting too, because for me, I sit there and I look at that and I'm like, man, I wonder what U.S. soccer candidate they're gonna pull. Like, you know, which Colt Twitter's favorite European soccer manager that's available. I wonder which one of those guys that Arsenal is actually gonna hire. And then, you know, there'll be some random, you know, guy in his basement is gonna be sitting there kicking himself that the U.S. Soccer Federation didn't get to him quicker before Arsenal's job opened. So it'll be some fun when we figure out all that happened there.
I think there's a lot of really curious thoughts to take up here, Dan. You know, like, if let's remove the fact that Patrick Vieira is a World Cup winner and, you know, all he did at Arsenal. I believe he was a member of the team during the Invincible seasons, but I'm not completely sure. My EPL knowledge is a little bit fuzzy in that area in that time for the league and for Arsenal. But, if we remove that, you know, skill and accomplishments at the player level, I can give you perspective as a manager, but then that doesn't necessarily always translate it. You know, you look at it when Patrick Vieira retired, you know, probably, you know, him and Thierry Henry, as far as the big Arsenal players, you know, some of the most decorated players in terms of what they've been able to bring. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, Michael Jordan would have been a great NBA basketball coach. We know that Wayne Gretzky was relatively pedestrian as far as a hockey coach. I don't know that those necessarily translate. And the one thing that he's kind of always had an advantage, you know, obviously Man City and all the oil money really helped him with the academy stuff. I think he's done a fantastic job with New York City FC. He also has all the resources in the world that would be available to an MLS team, where, you know, I always find it interesting, like, you know, if you put like Roy Hodgson with Chelsea, for example, or you take like Sir Alex Ferguson and give him like, you know, the 2013 DC United team, like, are they able to do anything with it? So I feel like if you remove everything that he had done in a player, like, there's no way this would happen. Like, there's no alternate, what does the alternate universe look like where the Arsenal job opens up and Bob Bradley or Bruce Arena or Greg Vanney or any of those American coaches or even Peter Vermees are even remotely in the conversation for it? It doesn't happen. So how much of this is just because, you know, Patrick Vieira has the Man City, you know, the City Football Group aura behind him from a coaching standpoint, and how much of this is because he was an Arsenal legend? I think the other thing is, you know, Arsenal is one of those clubs in the world from a branding standpoint that if you get an opportunity to do, which to go with them, that's a once in a lifetime chance, and you really shouldn't give it up. On the same, to your point, Dan, you know, you don't want to follow the legend, so to speak, you know, and who had, like, with the pressure and everything, like, you don't want to be the David Moyes or the Kurt Anolfo of a franchise following a legend, so to speak. And I feel like whoever gets to take over Arsenal, there's still going to be unreasonable expectations. It was a minor miracle, everything that Wenger was able to do within 2018, the seventh biggest budget and transfer fee spent in the Premier League. So, you know, I don't know what that coach is going to be able to do. And I feel like that whoever that is, even if that person is a better manager than Wenger, because his successor is going to be set up for failure. And that position is going to be open up in another year or two. I also feel like Vieira feels like he hasn't fully accomplished everything he wants with New York City FC. And I feel like he should try to finish that project. So I think it's really interesting. I think it's fun, and I think it's a good thing for MLS from a PR standpoint that the rumor is out there, even if it's actually not true. And the fact that, you know, a coach of one of the best teams right now and one of the teams aspiring to be a super club in MLS is being remotely linked to arguably one of the biggest coaching positions that's going to be available come this summer. Moving on, Dan, on the other side of New York and then also in the Eastern Conference, we've got a bunch of players who signed contract extensions this year, this week. New York Red Bulls extended their contracts for Daniel Royer and Sean Davis. Not a whole lot of details provided or a whole lot of rumors on those. I'm going to assume that those are multi-year deals and those guys are both still probably budget players. That might mean that Sean Davis is no longer officially a homegrown for the New York Red Bulls. And then also Pipe Higuain with Columbus Crew was going to be out of contract at the end of 2018. He has signed a one-year contract extension. He'll be with them through the end of the 2019 MLS season. He's currently a designated player, and based on his salary pending more Garber bucks being infused into it and Columbus seeing what they want to do with TAM or GAM or JAM or whatever is being invented, Federico Higuain is set to be a DP in 2019 as well. Dan, your general thoughts on these three players who I think, you know, deserved, you know, probably a little bit of a pay raise and some security given what they've provided for their clubs in recent seasons.
Yeah, so, I mean, Royer's been a huge part of what New York Red Bulls have done in their success. Sean Davis has really come out of his shell in the last couple of years, especially this season. You know, it's an encouraging sign to see someone like Sean Davis, who came up through their academy, was a homegrown player, get cemented in the first team, earn another first team contract that will most likely, remove his homegrown status. However, you know, that's the goal. That's the goal of the homegrown thing. And that's the goal of, MLS setting that up, is that, you know, these teams come through their academy and they assimilate, and hopefully it creates a better soccer product overall in the U.S. And, you know, good on Columbus for keeping Federico Higuain. When they move to Austin in a little bit, they're going to need some type of, I'm joking, I don't know anything, I'm joking on that. But, you know, to be morbid, you know, they're going to need some type of recognizable figure within MLS. And, you know, even if they, or if they do stick around in Columbus, is a lot of players jump ship. Like you've seen Justin Merriman, like you've seen Ola Kamara go, you see Ethan Finley that is gone from them as well. You know, this is something that was coming, you know, it's a good thing that Federico Higuain, you know, he's been a very good player since he's come to MLS, good on, you know, Columbus for making a good soccer move to keep him around. I don't know if they have much in the way of the pipeline, to necessarily replace Higuain if he were to walk at the end of this year. And there's not many that great options for the future in that position to, you know, go pick up from around MLS as well. So, you know, good moves all around. I'm fine with it. The Sean Davis thing, I think, is probably a little bit more special in my eye, though, just because it is, you know, he's one of the, you know, there aren't very many yet homegrown players that have been successful in integrating into a full team, a full contract with the first team, that is not on a homegrown status after their initial homegrown signing. So good on Sean Davis.
I'm going to agree with you completely, Dan. I feel like Royer and Davis, I wouldn't say they're at the absolute core, because I still feel like that's, you know, Tyler Adams, Luis Robles, Bradley Wright Phillips when it comes to the Red Bulls. But, you know, these are two definite glue players who are going to be major role players for the rest of this team. They're two players who Jesse Marsh has gotten a lot out of. And, you know, if they're your fourth and your fifth best starter on your team, you know, come the, you know, down the stretch in October and into the playoffs, I think the Red Bulls are going to be fine. So, you know, we don't yet know the numbers of where they're going to be in 2019, but I think, you know, both of those are good moves in terms of keeping those around from an asset standpoint for Jesse Marsh and company. And then I'm going to agree with you with Federico Higuain. He's been producing. He's been one of the key points, if not the most valuable player offensively for Greg Berhalter and Columbus Crew. He just joined the 50-50 club a couple weeks ago. Very prestigious as far as his production in this league. So I still think that he's going to be an impactful player in 2019, even though Father Time is undefeated. I kind of expect that maybe he takes a little bit of a pay cut, so maybe a lower-level DP. I don't have offhand the salary that he was making last year, and we're still a couple weeks away from getting the 2018 salaries for all of the players in MLS. But as long as it makes sense from a money standpoint, I think this is a good move for Columbus Crew. What happens after that, I'm not entirely sure, but if he keeps doing his thing, if Giassi Zardes continues to have his renaissance and not the pressure cooker that is the StubHub Center, and, you know, Pedro Santos and the guys keep ending the thing, Columbus Crew are going to be a force to be reckoned with down the stretch in this season. Moving on, Dan, finally, after six games on the road, Los Angeles Football Club will be playing their first home game of their entire existence in league play. They'll be hosting Seattle Sounders on Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on FS1. We do have this game as a pick'em, folks, but Dan, we've got some of the renderings out on everything of Bank of California Stadium, and it's absolutely gorgeous. They've got the huge supporters bar, and it's in a great location, you know, right next to the Coliseum and everything. What have you seen of some of the initial photos and stuff, and what do you think of it as far as, you know, a new soccer-specific stadium in the MLS 3.0 era?
It's a very nice soccer-specific stadium. You know, you know, as much as the stadium, you know, it looks cool, fine. A lot of these new stadiums are going to just look cool. That's just how it's going to go. What I like about what they've done, though, is that, you know, they've made it in an accessible part of LA. They are kind of with at least within LA. That's my fun joke to poke at with the Galaxy, is, you know, Carson is not entirely Los Angeles. If you've ever been there, it is far from LA. I really do like this, the stadium. It's going to be a cool feel. You know, it's always interesting when they open those stadiums, you know, what's the home field advantage going to look like, as these teams go within that stadium. Aesthetically, what's the stadium like during a game? Does the sound, how does it carry? How does it hold? I think they've done a good job of creating a roof that does help hold the sound. There's not a whole lot of holes in the stadium. It's a very, I mean, what is it, 27,000 seated, if I'm correct?
22,000.
Still one of the more ambitiously large soccer-specific stadiums in MLS. And I like the move. I like the stadium a lot. It looks nice. It'll be cool to see how it feels and looks on TV this weekend.
Absolutely. I'm going to agree with you, Dan. You know, great location. I can admit, as a born and raised, really, really nice renderings. I had someone who does not have a dog in the fight at all in El Trafico say that it kind of looked like a weirder, like more upper decky version of StubHub Center in terms of the shape of it and the roof. I don't necessarily see it, but, you know, if they want to compare that from an architectural standpoint, I do think that it's a little bit small. You might not have been at Last Word when I wrote this article, Dan, but it was one of the best ones that we had that season. I want to say it was the 2015 MLS season, where I essentially wrote this really, really long manifesto or thesis about the evolution of soccer-specific stadiums in MLS from a location standpoint, from a structural standpoint, and a few other different aspects. And one of the things that I kind of poked at everybody, at every team that had kind of built one, is the lack of being able to expand their stadiums, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, in the aspirations of the league to eventually become one of the top leagues in the world, to become one of, if not the major sports in America. You know, in theory, at some point down the road, there's going to be a point where all of these MLS stadiums that are in the high teens, thousands, or even the low 20,000 seats are just going to be a little bit too small when you compare it to, say, even remove some of the giant stadiums. You know, there's a number in the EPL that are in excess of 30,000. You look at the Bundesliga, where there's a lot of leagues that have stadiums in the 40,000s, and some of them have done a really good job about making room architecturally for expansion. Avaya Stadium has an open end zone that they could do a whole lot with. You know, there's a few others, and I just kind of wonder with, you know, both the location in terms of that being limiting in terms of space, them already expanding with the double deck, and then also putting the roof, I feel, is a little bit limiting. But, you know, maybe I'm just too pie in the sky thinking about, oh, what can we do right now to make things really, really easy in 2040, as opposed to making a really awesome stadium right now. So that's maybe, in the context of the growth of the league, my only big complaint. But other than that, great looking stadium. You know, hopefully it's absolutely full and has a really, really exciting atmosphere. In the one game of this weekend that I will be hoping that Bane shows up at, as far as MLS games are concerned. Moving on to some less fun news as far as our Minnesota listeners are concerned, Dan. It came out earlier today, or yesterday, the 25th, that Minnesota United winger Ethan Finley did in fact tear his ACL on national TV against Seattle over the weekend. That is now two ACL tears that the Loons have suffered this season. Kevin Molino is out for the season. Now Ethan Finley is out for the season. And Loons, you know, other than Darwin Quintero, you know, don't really have a whole lot going on offensively. You know, Adrian Heath apparently likes Abu Dhanlady over Christian Ramirez, even though Christian Ramirez, you know, is averaging basically a goal every other start in MLS, so to speak. What do you make of this? What does this make for the Loons? And are they doomed?
They're probably doomed at this point. You know, Sam Nicholson's been fine as a winger for him, but, you know, of course, it's Adrian Heath again who gets the short end of the stick in terms of injuries and roster compilation for as the manager there. But I don't see things going well for them at this point, missing two key attacking figures in Kevin Molino and now Ethan Finley. It sucks any time a player misses a significant portion of the year due to injury. He's not coming back this year. It'll be interesting to see what they do with him in the long term, because you remember with Josh Gott, who was eventually traded to the Rapids, his recovery from his torn ACL, I think multiple even torn ACLs, when he was in Europe and was this this potential, you know, he was in Scandinavia, this potential big talent coming forward super fast, and you know, ACL's tear, and he loses his step and he just can't really get back from it. And you know, it's a very, very hard injury to fully come back from if you are not fully fit for that. And it's going to be rough for him in the long term, and it's going to be rough for Minnesota United in the long term. And it just kind of sucks because, you know, you felt like you had some type of positivity coming out of their season at the start of it. The last couple of weeks have just been bad. You know, they get put through the ringer schedule-wise and have Atlanta, at Portland, at Seattle. Sorry, I'm yawning over here, but at the same time, you know, it doesn't come at a good time for them, and they've got a long way to go this season, missing some significant pieces of their attack going forward.
I completely agree with you, Dan. It sucks for Ethan Finley, who I felt was one of the good, maybe dark horse U.S. national team player going forward in terms of being involved in that. And, you know, obviously, you know, it was a big deal for him, you know, getting traded, you know, back to Minnesota to try and be something for that club that I think was in need of a little bit of a spark. So, you know, it sucks for him on a personal level. It sucks for him on a professional level. And, you know, it's just kind of another short end of the stick, as you said, that Minnesota's kind of gone through. You know, I really like what I've seen from Darwin Quintero, but, you know, is now Minnesota finally deciding to spend money on an attacking piece? Is that enough to replace what Kevin Molino would have brought you in 2018 and what Ethan Finley would have brought you in 2018? No, not really. And we don't need to rehash, you know, all the things that have gone wrong for them defensively. So their defense isn't a whole lot better, and they've probably lost, you know, let's assume Quintero wasn't signed as a replacement for Kevin Molino. You've lost arguably two of your top four attacking pieces for 2018 through the rest of the season, and another one is supposedly on the out, so to speak. I don't see how it gets a whole lot better here for Minnesota, and barring a massive structure change from ownership that has them spending a whole lot of money in the summer, which we have not seen any indication from so far in their MLS existence, you know, I don't see how this team gets out of what is going to be a really crowded and really competitive Western Conference. Moving on that note, Dan, the window for the, I guess, I guess it's technically the winter transfer window, since it started in January and now it's kind of expanded. In any case, the transfer window prior to the post-World Cup summer mid-season transfer window for MLS will be closing later next week, Dan. Most teams have done most of the trading that they want. There's not a whole lot of movement in international slots, so not a lot for teams to do as far as bringing in international talent is concerned, just because there's only so many available, and now their price is going to go up due to scarcity. Not a whole lot of teams doing a whole lot on the allocation. There's not a whole lot of American talents out there, but Lee Wynn is still kind of, you know, bouncing around in the ether, existing, we think, somewhere in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Bobby Wood, you know, has had kind of rumblings, and is it happening or is it not happening? Chicago needs to make some moves. Let's have kind of similar to our MLS preview pod, where we make a bunch of crazy MLS predictions. What sort of crazy late window MLS transfers do you see happening? And what would you like to see happening, you know, in your MLS fan fiction you'll be writing later tonight?
So I am going to, here's a trade that I'm going to propose. I'm going to propose the San Jose Earthquakes trading Anibal Godoy and a good amount of TAM to, not TAM, but by good amount, I don't mean Dom Dwyer levels of TAM. I'm talking like, you know, barely
just several hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I'm talking like max $400,000. If I'm the San Jose Earthquakes, I'm sending Anibal Godoy and TAM to the New England Revolution for Lee Nguyen. The San Jose Earthquakes are missing a true central playmaker underneath the strikers, whatever they're going to do with that going forward. Anibal Godoy has honestly, remember that play earlier this year where it was kind of making rounds on Twitter where Liam Bridgewell just pulled out of the attack and stuff like that, out of the counterattack and the defensive stuff, and just let a guy ghost in unmarked and score on him? Pretty much hasn't made much of any appearance since. Anibal Godoy has done that multiple times this year, and he's shown a good lack of hustle plenty of times for the San Jose Earthquakes. It has been noted by plenty of Earthquakes fans and reporters as well. It's funky and interesting considering he just signed a contract extension and he's going into a World Cup summer with Panama. And I don't know if he's just phoning it in and waiting for the World Cup to come and, you know, to get some European offer to move. But, you know, he looks like the absolute shell of the Anibal Godoy that we had seen in the past. I think the Earthquakes could potentially be ready to move on for something like that. And they really do need a central creative force. So let's say I'm Jesse Friorinelli. I am sending Godoy and a little bit of cash New England's way for Lee Nguyen. That's my craziest late window idea. I don't really see, other than like, you know, Sporting Kansas City sending all the gam and tam for Zlatan, which I don't even think they really would need a striker like that at this point. I don't, you know, I'm trying to even think of a type of striker that would totally fit Sporting Kansas City, and it's funny because it might actually be Dom Dwyer, who they traded away last year. But, you know, I like what Sporting Kansas City has been doing. I don't really have any ideas for them. I think they're going to shop internationally for the summer window because they've had multiple things that didn't kind of fully come to fruition. But I'm going to go with a team that probably could use some strike force help. Enter the newest designated player for the Minnesota United, Jackson Martinez, as he has left the Chinese Super League and his millions of dollars after having a significant knee injury that he has reportedly fully recovered from, but was not ready to go anymore in China. They need some help in the attack. Go get Jackson Martinez. I don't know. That's about the craziest thing I can come up with, because, you know, the way this window works is, unless we get a Kai Kamara-esque happening between somebody and their captain or somebody and another player during a penalty kick thing, that we're not going to see a whole lot of movement leading into this. But there's my crazy ideas. Jackson Martinez to Minnesota as a designated player, and go for it with Lee Nguyen going to San Jose Earthquakes.
I was trying to come up with a crazy Lee Nguyen fit that would actually happen. You know, we know Chicago and probably bit of jolt offensively, maybe even Minnesota as well. But I actually think yours might actually work from the standpoint of the other team, of the team trading for Lee Wynn, having the assets to give and actually giving something new that New England are in need of. You know, New England needs a little bit of bite in the midfield. I think Anibal Godoy could actually provide that. I think he might actually need a change of scenery, so to speak. So I think that's actually a move that could actually work with both teams, Dan. So I'm going to completely scrap that. But in the process of you providing that, I came up with something crazy that won't happen, but it's going to be fun to talk about. Give me, you know, maybe some random academy kid that has a little bit of potential, or, you know, maybe a little bit of cash and Emma Boateng for Liam Ridgewell between the LA Galaxy and the Portland Timbers. The Galaxy defense, you know, still needs a little bit of help. You know, Jorgen Kjelvik is still getting used to MLS. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, Daniel Starris is an above average USL defender, and that's really about it. Michael Ciani is old, slow, and can't stay healthy. And for some reason, Siggy Smith doesn't really want to give Tomas Hiliard-Arce a run out in that for some reason. So, you know, give me Liam Ridgewell, who's a veteran MLS defender in a new situation. And clearly the Timbers need help on the wing. You know, like, other than last Sunday against New York City FC, basically their entire offense has been Diego Valeri and a bunch of unpaid interns. Like, Emma Boateng has kind of absorbed Giassi Zardes' poor touch, but at the very least he's going to get out and run, and he's going to make somebody have to mark him. That worst case scenario gives Diego Valeri a little bit more room to do Diego Valeri things. I do not think at all that's going to happen. I don't think the Galaxy are shopping Emma Boateng. I don't think the Timbers are shopping Liam Ridgewell. I don't think either of those teams give up that asset to another Western Conference team, but that's a little fun thing to think about. I don't see the Rapids making any big move. They've already, you know, added 14 changes from last season to this season. Anthony Hudson likes where he is. I did report on a little bit of a scuffle between him and Stefan Aigner that kind of has Aigner not playing since the Philadelphia Union game. But just given where his money is and his fitness-wise, I just don't see another team absorbing that unless the Rapids are eating a whole bunch of his salary, which is basically consuming all the TAM that they have left. So I don't really see that a whole lot happening. But, you know, I still think something is going to happen. I don't think it's going to be that major, Dan. I think Chicago needs to do something. I think Philly probably needs to do something. But outside of those two, you know, I don't think anything crazy is going to happen. You know, you might see somebody flip a draft pick for a bench player. You might see like a Jared Watts-like trade, you know, where Houston needed a little bit of help at holding midfielder and at center back. Oh, we'll give you 150 in GAM or TAM. I could see maybe two or three of those trades happening, but I don't think we'll see a Dom Dwyer-like move or a Darlington Nagbe move or a David Akam or any significant pieces. The only one piece would be Lee Wynn. And at this point, like, if with all the fielding of stuff and, you know, the reports that New England, you know, were offered $750,000 in total allocation money and turned it down, I just, if that wasn't good enough for you, I don't see how they move him, but I think they need to. But what has the Revolution front office done in the last 4 years to give me faith that they'll do a smart economic decision? Even in the immediate present, it's a little bit like ripping a band-aid off. Moving on, Dan, let's get to weekend pick-ems. We're going with the national televised games and the games on Sunday. Dan, we will start with an absolute slog between the Philadelphia Union hosting DC United. This will be on Saturday, April 26th, folks, on Unimas at 3:30 p.m. Eastern. Dan, who do you have winning this game, or is this an absolute draw between possibly two of the worst teams in Major League Soccer?
Oh, I'm going full on 0-0 draws. It's going to be a snoozer. Neither team cracks 10 shots attempted. And here we go. This is the kicker on this. I believe that there are more likely 4 to 5 USL games on the slate that would be entirely more exciting than this matchup on Saturday.
I'm going to agree with you, Dan. I'm actually going to throw something on. United gets at most one shot on goal in this one. I don't see teams doing a whole lot. You know, we were joking. We hit the record button. Like, is this, like, this game is going to be the answer to the question, like, what if you have two teams that can't possess the ball, can't defend, playing Route 1 soccer against each other? I'm excited for this one in the sense that, like, I'm excited to, like, hate watch really, really terrible, like, a Spanish soap opera just to see, like, the main character's evil twin come back and, like, have everybody be super shocked, but maybe, like, this is absolutely terrible. Why is anybody actually watching this, so to speak? Moving on, all three games that we have left here, folks, will all be on Sunday, April 27th. We're going to start at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, the only, or at least the first, it might be the only, Colorado Rapids nationally televised game of the season. They will be hosting Orlando City SC at 4 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Dan, I will be on location hanging out with the 12 dog. Orlando City likes to score a lot of goals, but win them close. The Rapids like to not let a whole lot of goals in and win them close. Is this a 1-0 or is this a 5-4 like goal fest?
I think this is going to be an interesting one. I'm going to go with the 2-2 draw on this just because I like what Colorado has done so far under Anthony Hudson. They've kind of impressed me more than they have, like, shocked me in a bad way. This Orlando City team has been playing really well recently, but they almost coughed up a 3-0 lead to the San Jose Earthquakes, and the Earthquakes have been terrible since the first game of the year. So, and they did it at home. So, you know, this is a Rapids team that's got a lot of big bodies that likes to get in there and score on some corner, and they could do something on a set piece. Orlando City cannot defend set pieces, and, you know, this is Colorado is at home. Altitude is always annoying as heck to play in, especially for a team from Florida. So, you know, this is going to be a really interesting matchup, I think. I'm going to go with the Rapids on, like I said, I did say a 2-2 draw, but if there is any winner in this, I actually might think that the Rapids could pull off this win, just considering, you know, the circumstances. And with them being at altitude, Eastern Conference teams always do terrible with that. And this is actually a pretty decent Rapids team, and I'm impressed with what Anthony Hudson has done with them so far.
I'm going to agree with you, Dan. I think this is most likely a 1-1 draw for me. There is winner, then I think it's the Colorado Rapids. Styles make fights, and I think this game is ultimately going to come down to who imposes their will and their style of play on this. This is a slow build-up-y play, that build-up-y game, you know, with a lot of, you know, little spurts of possession and teams bunkering in and the Rapids getting a whole lot of opportunities on corners, then I think that favors the Rapids. If this is a run and gun where, you know, if you don't score, you're immediately giving the other team an odd man counterattack, then I think that favors Orlando City SC. I think the one thing tactically that's going to be a little bit interesting here, for all the good things that we've seen from Stefan Pino and Mueller, I can't remember how to pronounce that, from an out wide position, they haven't really played another team that likes to play out on the wings and have their wing backs, or I guess fullbacks in this case for the Rapids, it'll be wing, challenge them and force them to do anything defensively. We know Orlando City's defense can be had, and if their fullbacks are out on an island against the likes of Edgar Castillo and potentially Marlon Harrison, who's coming back from injury, then I think that definitely favors them. Or do they force Pino and Mueller to defend? I think that's the one thing that's going to be a little bit interesting there from that standpoint. But I think it's going to be fun to see, and I'm really excited to see a game on ESPN at DSGP. Moving on, listeners, New York City FC hosting FC Dallas. This will be at 6:30 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Dan, who do you have in this match?
I'm going to go with the New York City FC in this one. I like what FC Dallas has done to just kind of ride the wave and, you know, hope they can pull out a win here and there. They are the last unbeaten team, but they're definitely by far not the best team in MLS. And, you know, I think the results have kind of showed that for them. They've had a couple of meh draws and a couple of wins here that have been okay against not very great opponents in recent weeks. They're going to be on the road. You know, road teams don't always do well with the postage stamp pitch at Yankee Stadium. New York City FC has been good, really good at home. They've been really good all year. I think they're going to be kind of out with a vengeance after that result in Portland to kind of show people that, you know, it might have just kind of a fluky game for them. A lot of teams have done that so far, and I think this will really be the tell on, okay, did New York City FC just get out to a hot start, or are they this good? And if they come out here and don't put out a hey, we're going to send a message type performance, then you look at that team's mentality and wonder if they are actually as good as that record started for them. So this is a crucial game for New York City FC, I think, to put themselves back on the right foot. They're at home. I'm going to go with them doing that because they haven't given me any other, you know, their mentality to come back multiple times on the road has been there. So usually teams that have that are teams that that have that mentality to come back out and, you know, try and prove the last game, the last bad result is one-off. So I'm going to go with New York City FC in this one, considering they're at home. I'm going to go with a 2-0 win against FC Dallas.
I'm going to agree with you, Dan. I'm also going to say that it's going to be a 2-0 game. You know, every team in MLS stink. You know, it was a really, really them. They've had a busy schedule. They've had some injuries. And, you know, Portland had their backs against the wall. So everybody's going to have one of those results. I still think New York City FC so far has been the best team in MLS on the road and at home. SC Dallas being a Western Conference team, this will just be their second game at Yankee Stadium in the history of NYCFC. So, you know, you see how Patrick Vieira has particularly gotten it to where teams come in and they're not as familiar with the venue, whereas, you know, NYCFC play about half their games there, that they're really, really good at gaming how the systems play, such that how they play at home on a small pitch is different from how they play on, say, you know, this 75 by 120 yard field, you know, when they go to some of the wider pitches in this league, so to speak. FC Dallas, just their second game in there. It's not like an Eastern Conference team where they can go back and look at what happened last season or what happened earlier this season, so to speak. Definitely home field advantage for New York City FC. And, you know, I think there is a little bit of bulletin board material here in the sense that we were the last undefeated team in the Eastern Conference. We have a chance to give the last undefeated team in all of MLS their first loss when they haven't been that impressive. Give me 2-0 to New York City FC. I'll go with David Villa getting a goal, and give me Angel Herrera on a – not Angel Herrera. He does not – the different player. Excuse me. Jesus Medina, excuse me, for New York City FC scoring on the counter. I almost started a really crazy rumor there, folks. And then lastly, this will be the night match on Sunday. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, Los Angeles FC opening up the Bank of California Stadium against Seattle Sounders FC. This will be on Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Dan, who you got? And more importantly, are we just rooting for Bain to show up in this one? I think that's the one thing we can agree on here.
Yeah, this is going to be – I'm not excited about this match. I like when new teams open their new stadium, and it's, you know, it's all fun and stuff. It's cool. I like checking out the new atmosphere, and that's about the only interest I'll have in this game. Just because it's LAFC, meh. I like what they do. I think they're kind of entertaining, but their defense is an absolute mess. If they run into any kind of good defensive team, they're going to have issues. I wouldn't consider the Seattle Sounders a good defensive team yet. I don't even know if they're a good team yet. They you know, kind of got on the board with a draw in Kansas City. They got lucky. Sporting Kansas City were not up to their best. And then you have, you know, they get a win at home against Minnesota, who are significantly injured and not very good just in general. So, you know, is Seattle good? I don't know. LAFC has just made a really good picking off of terrible defensive teams with the attack that they have. I don't think Seattle are a terrible defensive team, but I don't think they're that great. I don't see this being a wonderful game to watch. It's either going to be terrible or it's going to be like 5-4. And it's, you know, it'll be a 5-0 lead for LAFC, and they'll cough up 4 in the final 15 minutes and make everybody sweat. I do think I'm going to go with LAFC in this one just because I believe in the new stadium bump. I have a hard time remembering a team outside of Minnesota United that has gotten destroyed in its quote-unquote home opener. Minnesota United, their game against Atlanta United last year that was a bloodbath. But, you know, I wouldn't call that much of a home opener, as they didn't really open that stadium. I have literally tried to rack my brain to find some team in MLS that had their quote-unquote stadium opening game spoiled, especially in recent memory for teams who have gotten it. I believe Houston won theirs. I believe, you know, Atlanta has won theirs when they opened Mercedes-Benz.
They won at Mercedes-Benz, but I believe they lost their opener at Bobby Dodd to New York Red Bulls. I don't know if we want to count that, but that was like a 3-2 game. That was a close one.
Right, and that's why I wasn't really necessarily counting the Minnesota-Atlanta game. You can kind of count it, but not really, because it's, you know, it's just at another stadium. So what? They destroyed them at Mercedes-Benz, I believe, and they destroyed them. The Earthquakes beat the Chicago Fire at Avaya Stadium. It was one of the last, soccer-specific games that I can – soccer-specific stadiums opening that I can remember. So LAFC, just because of that bump and that atmosphere kind of feel that they're playing against their home fans, a whole stadium full of them for the first time, that bump will happen, and I'm going to take them beating the Seattle Sounders. But I'm going Barnstorm, and I'll say 4-3.
I'm going to agree with you. I think this could get to be a really, really ugly game. Ozzie Alonso has back for the Seattle Sounders. You know, I know they've got a little bit of issues defensively. They don't have a whole lot going offensively right now. You know, Clint Dempsey is a super sub now. Nico Adair is a little bit all over the place. You know, Will Bruin's still trying to find himself in the aftermath of what happened. It's Estadio Akron in CCL. So, you know, I think that this is a game where Seattle, you know, maybe comes out and says, like, let's try and counter, but, like, let's muck up the game and be absolutely ugly. And I think, you know, with Christian Roldan and Ozzie Alonso in the midfield, they'll absolutely be able to do that. But, you know, if this was a game where LAFC and if this is the game where LAFC and Seattle, you know, were, you know, had been in the league for 4 or 5 years and this wasn't a brand new stadium opening, if this was just your run of the mill home opener, you know, 3 to 4 weeks into the season, I'd probably be picking this game differently. But I'm going to agree with you on the stadium bump here, Dan. I'm going to say 2-1 to LAFC, but this is going to be a really foully game. I think there's going to be a lot of yellow cards. Fel Hubbard does not like the Seattle Sounders. The Seattle Sounders do not like him. I think that's going to play into it. And it's going to be a little bit of an ugly game, but I do think LAFC gets it done ultimately. That does it for us, folks. Dan, what are your last words and what are your thoughts on, unfortunately, what the Sharks are doing right now?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the Sharks, but we've got Dan okay. Matt Derby.
Dan Matt Derby
continues. This is what happens when you have an LA fan and a Bay Area fan. We play each other a lot because of interdivision stuff. Dodgers Giants this weekend, my attention's going to be on that for a good portion. I will be, of course, up for all the MLS stuff. Last words, you know what, folks, just get rid of the terrible takes about Michael Bradley. I am, you know, I might even put in my Twitter name and change it to like hashtag Michael Bradley defender or somebody like that, because I am all about defending who Michael Bradley is as a soccer player. I think he's still overall a great dude. Yes, some unfortunate things have happened, quote unquote, under his watch, but he is one of the best midfielders that the United States Soccer Federation has ever had, and he should be remembered as such, and I think he will farther down the road. Don't let just a sky penalty kick make your judgment on a player who's had a wonderful 10 plus years with the U.S. national team. So, you know, overall, I am excited for the soccer weekend, and, you know, Dan Matt Derby goes full on this weekend as well.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And my big last word of for promotion, Dan, I have a soft spot in my heart for every single English Premier League or European team that has a strong history of American supporters, so to speak. I was absolutely devastated, you know, when Fulham getting relegated basically doomed Emerson Hyman with the Cottagers. So really, really rooting for them to get back in it. You know, I think it's going to be fun to have another, you know, low level London team in the Premier League along with Crystal Palace. Really hoping for them to stay up along with one of my really good Rapids friends here in Colorado, Richard Terry, who's a besottled member of C38. So really, really hoping that the Eagles stay up, hoping the Cottagers get up. And I mean, like, Sunderland's doomed, so Sunderland's doomed. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWS Matt Pollard. Dan, since you didn't say it, follow Dan on Twitter at SperryDaniel94, or I guess look for hashtag Michael Bradley Defender as his username. Check out all of our collective musings on MLS at lastwordonsoccer.com. You can subscribe to Last Word SC Radio. Just search Last Word or LWOS Radio wherever you find your podcasts. We're pretty much everywhere. Thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of Major League Soccer, the United Soccer League, and U.S. Soccer in general. Get your custom scarves for your group or your team or just yourself at roughneckscarves.com. Enjoy all of your MLS weekend, folks. There's a bunch of really, really exciting games to go. We'll be back next week with a bunch of action and more thoughts on what's happening. We'll see you then.